Hello everyone and welcome to Projector Room. Once again, it's the middle of October and it's 195. We're really sorry, aren't we, Alan Gilday, that we missed our show 2 weeks ago.
Sorry, sir, I'll be ever so good in the future, I will.
Welcome to you and welcome to Gareth as well. Hello, Gareth.
Hello there. I haven't been off being as hunky as Mr. Gilday, but...
Yeah, well, few can. That's true. But it's good to reconvene.
Yes, indeed. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find me, and GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth. I've been clocking this week that Gareth has been doing a few film reviews, so do check that out on his website. We've got evidence here, Gareth, of someone actually listening to our show. Take it away, will you?
Well, yes, I got an email from Paul saying, good morning, just catching up on the Projector Room, which means he's listened to more than one of them. Just catching up on Projector Room. It looks like someone beat me to it regarding Alien Earth 2025, which is a TV show that I talked on about on the last show to quite a bit of length, actually, come to think of it. I couldn't believe your comments when this was soon to be aired. I'm now 7 episodes in, and it just gets better and better. If you can get the chance, watch it and catch up quickly. I won't give away any spoilers, but episode 6 was fantastic.
Oh, good. Next episode. I was struggling to get through this, to be honest. But the stuff that's based back on Earth seems really boring. Episode 5, I'm glad that 6 is better, because episode 5 seemed to pick up. The whole of the episode was on the spaceship, and it started to feel like Alien then. Up to that, it's just been like boring, bore. Let's get to it.
All right, okay. Well, Paul carries on. Also, if you get a chance, Atomic is very good. Only 5 episodes, but after the first one, you'll be hooked. The final episode is clearly set up for season 2, and I still don't know exactly what's happening at the end. Hopefully, you've watched this and could share some light on your views. Well, thanks very much, Paul, for writing in. Alien Earth, I did manage to finish it. I had to rush off to on an international adventure soon after, but Alien Earth, I did thoroughly enjoy it right up until the last episode. And the last episode felt quite weak, but I think in the larger picture, I think it ended quite well with
enough questions
open for... I'm not spoiling anything. I've done this before, you know.
No spoilers.
It's leaving enough questions open for a season 2. You know, not glaring questions, but enough to that they could end it at the end of season 1. But, you know, they can make a season 2 if they want season 2, which I believe they are doing. But I just felt, you know, a lot of people are giving it a lot of flack because that last episode wasn't as high quality as
the previous episode had been.
I love it, and I was thinking more about it, and it's because I love the world, the environment of Alien so much. It's wonderful to be able to sit down for 7-8 hours. Is it 8 hours? Eight episodes?
Certainly
it?
Is. Yeah.
In that world, and just soak it all up. with the, you know, the costumes and all that kind of stuff. So it was wonderful to just, you know, completely divulge myself in the Alien world, and so many people are finding that too. The Atomic, I've watched the first episode, but I haven't gotten back to it yet. I have it on my watch list for the rest of it. And I've got through just the first episode. No, I'm thoroughly enjoyed it. But Ted, you've had a go with Atomic as well, haven't you?
I have. I've watched it all, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good show, very well done. The two leads are, you know, really engaging throughout. In fact, the lead actor reminded me of Dennis Waterman. When you're watching this thing, you think, oh yeah, Minder. It's just like Minder. It's about these two guys who get caught up in this cartel's uranium smuggling thing across North Africa. And yeah, it's really well done, really gripping, edge of the seat stuff, right to the end. And unlike Alien Earth, it doesn't take half of the series to get going.
Divided opinion, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. So I think you'll enjoy it, Gareth. Give it a go. Me and Paul agree. Right, Irfan Ali is next, Gareth.
Okay, Irfan has written in about Marvel Zombies, which is a TV miniseries on Disney Plus. It's four episodes long, 30 minutes long each, and he wishes they were a wee bit longer. He says it's based on a comic book series of the same name. I believe it's based off one of the What If episodes where some of the Avengers had been turned into zombies. I hear Ted groan.
No, I like zombies. No, zombies are okay.
But you don't like the Avengers, though.
The original Avengers, I do. The TV show.
Not the Diana Rigg and John Steele ones. Yeah. The audience is looking for a groan. Give us a groan. fans of anime should enjoy it. As always, as a series two, or season two, continuation is heavily hinted at. Thoughts or feelings on this. But then Ted sounds very positive that he wants to watch all of this twice.
No, I don't. I just quite like zombie things. But if they're also Marvel, Avengers, superhero people as well, I'm not so sure.
As done by Disney, which is another negative. As far as I'm concerned.
Okay, Alan, what's next?
Thank you so much. Duncan Robertson reports on Steve from 2025. And Duncan says, genuinely moving, gritty day in the life of Steve, a stressed head teacher with a secret alcohol and substance abuse problem, working at a last chance reform school for a set of chaotic but ultimately lovable boys. It's a bit like ourselves, who have been chucked out of mainstream education. Set in 1996, but with lots of contemporary themes around boys' education and austerity, it is based on a shy, unfilmable novel by Max Porter, which has flipped the focus to Steve. The titular character is played brilliantly by Cillian Murphy, and supported well by Tracy Ullman, Emily Watson, and a new teacher, rapper Little Sims. The film follows the story of... sounded quite incongruous, but still, the film follows the story of the staff keeping order and trying to help the boys, notably Shy, beautifully played by Jay Lasergo, on an incident-filled, stressful day. It's filled with black humour and ultimately some signs of hope and redemption for these people. As a parent of a teen boy, there might have even been a tear in my eyes. The film comes to an end with an emotional, hopeful voiceover from Steve himself. But no spoilers, Ted! So thank you very much, Duncan. That was really nice. And that sounds great. Character driven, well observed. And it sounds to me like it might echo a little bit with Meantime, which we're going to look at in detail together shortly.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Next up is Chad Dixon on Benny Safdie's film, The Smashing Machine. If there's any film that is even less likely to attract me, it'll be this one, by the way. Chad praises the movie as a perfect vehicle for its star, Dwayne Johnson, who shows his acting prowess. It's a biopic about an American professional wrestler, Mark Kerr, and his increasing reliance on painkillers as he prepares for a crucial fight in a Tokyo tournament. Ryan Bader and Emily Blunt are solid. He compares it to, compares it to The Wrestler of 2008 because of the gritty feel and handheld style. I assume he means handheld style of camera work. Actual combat sportsmen filled the supporting roles and the sound design immerses, says Chad. And I'm going to put a link in the show to Chad's full review on that because I have callously edited it down in order to save time. But, do go and have a look and a read of Chad's review on that one. If you like the sound of sport and American people and wrestling.
It's getting a lot of negative reviews, as far as I understand, but I haven't seen it, so I'd like to make up my own mind.
Okay.
I saw some fairly positive reviews for it, especially for Dwayne Johnson's acting work and his hair.
Yeah. All right, good. good. So what do you got next, Chris?
Well, that'll be Chris Clayton on Nobody 2 from the sequel to Nobody.
Yes, hey.
What a good time this was. 90 minutes in and out. Lots of violence, fun and humour. A throwback to a time when films were made for entertainment and didn't cost $300 million. A time for activist shit written by a millennial cat owner.
Hooray, well said,
like
Chris.
The first one, if you like the first one, you'll like this. Thanks, Chris. I haven't got around to this. I certainly will be doing, but I imagine Ted actually got on this one because he likes this franchise very, very much.
I have, but I haven't watched the second one yet. But I did really enjoy the first one. We spoke at length about the first one on this very show, and we all really thought it was great fun. So hopefully this one will be just as much. Obviously, Chris thinks so, so that's great.
So I would go as far to say that on this podcast, nobody has seen Nobody 2, but everybody has seen Nobody 1. He's got another one coming out as well, called Normal or something like that. It's I think it also begins with N. Is old Bob Odenkirk? It looks really good as well. I saw a trailer for it while I was away, and it looked really cool.
Yep. Happy days. That sounds great. Sorry for the interjection there from Tucker Carlson. That won't happen again. I fired him forthwith. So can I just report back? Chad Dixon has got something on nine bodies in a Mexican morgue from 2025, which is 6 42-minute episodes. And Chad says, a mystery. Sorry, I don't think I let you finish on that. Didn't somebody else have another comment about Nobody 2?
Nobody did too.
Flawlessly, smoothly read, Al. Here we go. A mystery drama currently on the BBC iPlayer and is how Lost should have been. Eight strangers and two crew were on their way home from Central America when an unexpected empty fuel tank forced the pilot to crash land in the remote Mexican jungle. Obviously, nobody has signal on their phone, correct? Mega trope. A race to organise food and water supply ensues. They decide to sit tight and wait for the inevitable rescue by the authorities. After the badly wounded pilot succumbs to his injuries, tensions and accusations build up fast as one or more of them are not quite who they say they are and why they were on the plane. Only a couple of faces were familiar to me, says Chad. Eric McCormick from Will and Grace, Kevin Anderson, Siobhan McSweeney from Derry Girls, and a solid ensemble performance. The twists and turns of the plot keep you constantly guessing as to what's really going on. The sultry jungle location feels claustrophobic. It's a gripping watch and easily bingeable in a single day. The reveal at the end is definitely rewarding, so I highly recommend this mini TV series. Thank you very much, and the full review that Chad's been good enough to send us is available. It's linked in the show notes, and we've just curtailed that a little bit in the interest of time. So,
Alan, you're getting the hang of this now, aren't you?
I've done it before, mate. I've done it before.
That sounds quite interesting.
It does.
Gareth, what do you think?
Well, actually, it's the same as something else that has just started called was The Last Frontier, which is another plane crash, but in the middle of Alaska. But I'm wondering about the title here: Nine Bodies in a Mexican Morgue. I'm guessing this is a small plane with potentially nine passengers on board, which doesn't bode well for the survivors. I don't know how many people are on the plane.
It says eight strangers and two crew, he says.
Yep. So there's 10 on the plane.
Looks like it.
What was that grueling one that we watched about the people having to eat their friends?
Oh,
that was a hard watch. Yeah. But it was a brilliant film.
The remake of Alive.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah, that was the one. Oh man, just leave me. I'll eat the Mars bars.
Were you going to say anything else, Gareth, before we move on?
No, that's fine.
Are you sure? You might have gathered by now, dear listener, that we're racing through this because we missed a show. There's so much to cover here, isn't there, Alan? Flop of the Fortnight is next, and I think these are yours, aren't they?
Yeah. So, in the interest of speed, Highest to Lowest, which is a 2025 film by Spike Lee, is shit. And then there's Old Guard 2, 2025, which is also pants. There you go.
That's the one with Denzel, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh, guys. I kid you not. So.
Denzel made a shit film?
Spike Lee has made some terrific films and some abysmal films in my estimation. This is not an abysmal film in my estimation. This is objectively appalling, shockingly badly made. I kid you not. The dialogue was sub-film school. The direction was all over the place. The camera angles didn't match. A lot of the visual effects, you could tell that they were sort of green screen, cutting away to live action, then cutting back to green screen and stuff. And I made it 25 minutes into that film, and I had to turn it off because I could not wade through the rubbish. Now, one of the other key things, and obviously Denzel's just an incredible actor, but the script was so bad that I was like cringing into the sofa watching one of my favorite actors choosing to perform in this manner. There's massive long scenes of people just explaining everything to each other. People who know each other very, very well, like a husband and wife, explaining their actions to each other, explaining their reasons and their feelings to each other. And then he goes on he's a music producer, and I think he's being asked to sign some new kid or something. I didn't even get that far into the thing. He goes into work to meet a former colleague, and then the two of them sit down and explain the music industry to each other. I kid you not, it's that bad. And on top of this massive, indulgent, completely expositional, clunky, prolonged dialogue, he pours this syrupy music over it at a very high volume as well. So I just have no clue what they were hoping to achieve. It's unwatchable. Kind of like there's this kind of gloomy, orchestral, sentimental, all the way through this bombastic dialogue about the state of the music. I've yet to see anything quite as bad. And what's shocking about it is that it wasn't made by sort of first-year film students. It was the work of some of the most accomplished and highly paid people on the planet.
Apple really beggars belief.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what happened. It honestly is a glitch in the matrix, because everybody not only dropped the ball, but kind of like punted it out into the pond, and nobody retrieved it. It's dreadful. It would definitely get a zero from me.
It's really surprising.
No excuse.
It's really surprising because we've come to expect Apple stuff to be a cut above most other things these days, and then suddenly there's a blooper.
And also, like, as I say, Spike Lee has turned in some, you know, pretty groundbreaking acclaimed work, and clearly Denzel is pretty much a god amongst actors. Mm-hmm. So there's no excuse. It's completely subpar. It would be like taking a Michelin chef and then burning a fish finger sandwich for you, you know, and then charging you 90 quid for it in a hotel. It's just diabolically, shockingly bad. And then Old Guard 2, which I, you know, had an evening off and thought, right, I'll watch something. Couldn't find anything on Amazon or Netflix. And in the end, I kind of thought, I'll give this a go. And it was just kind of obviously pretty lame, hackneyed, generic stuff from the outset. And I went, well, you know, that's fine. I'm just ordering a pizza. That'll do fine. I'm not expecting too much. But again, it was DEI by numbers. The action sequence set pieces were really stodgy and boring. Girl boss stuff, you know, girl boss John Wick, but without any kind of real kinetic impetus or sense of impact or the fight sequences just felt clunky and a bit staid and, you know, boring. And again, like 15, 20 minutes into that, I just bailed because it was utterly like our friend was saying earlier, super lefty woke propaganda, but not done well, you know, which, so for example, the current film from Paul Anderson is, you know, woke propaganda, but it's done very well because it's like DiCaprio and, you know, Thomas Anderson Paul Thomas Anderson directing. And so it's a film which has divided opinion, but it's nobody's saying it's devoid of artistry. You know, it's an extremely well made movie.
Don't Shoot an Eye or something. Got
it. No, every battle or something. Day's a battle or something like that. Anyway, these are just dreadful. Just give them a wide berth, unless you just want a shot in the arm. You know how shockingly awful these are.
You and Chris Clayton get on well together, I reckon. Right, Alan, lead us straight into it's a private screening, and you set us our homework last time.
Yes, this was a film from 1983 by Mike Lee called Meantime, and it's kind of overseen by Mike Lee. It's written as a improv, as a sort of extended improv with all the actors, so it's a collaboration. There isn't a script per se, so he steers the improv and out of that hones the film. It's called Meantime, and it's a little sort of kitchen sink drama set during and filmed during the Thatcher years in a very bleak part of London, and it really is the story of two brothers. And it's as inconsequential as one of the brothers is, you know, being encouraged by an auntie to come and do some decorating at her house. And the other brother is somewhat sabotaging that because he feels, on the surface, it's just because he's a bit of a mean-spirited tosser. Ultimately, one comes to a point where you kind of realize there may be other reasons behind his behavior. And there's a kind of redemption, if you like, towards the end of the film. Very, very little going on the film on the surface. As I say, it's just, you know, quite extended, you know, family over dinner, or somebody trying to fix a washing machine, or a mate walking through a park or down a canal trying to sponge a tin of beer off somebody else. So it's extremely low-key, cinema verite, kitchen sink. And has noted for, obviously, Mike Lee steering the thing, but also breakthrough, I think, debut performances from Gary Oldman and from Tim Roth. And I'm going to hand over to Tedward for your appraisal.
Gary Oldman and Tim Roth were just gobsmackingly young. I didn't for a while even recognise Tim Roth because he played the brother that was the less kind of forthright person. But mm-hmm. Gary Oldman, who played some sort of kind of hangout friend, he was just like, wow, he was so young. I was just so shocked. The rest of it, I didn't know it was not scripted or whatever. So you opened my eyes there. Perhaps I should have read about it. But yeah, it's all the things that you just said. The highlight for me, funnily enough, was the some of the music. I really liked this kind of knackered piano or this harpsichord or whatever it was, which just kind of gets injected now and again to I'm not quite sure why, but it just was really nice. I thought it was a nice kind of tune thing going on. I think it was too long, but then maybe that's the point of it. It was, you know, a fly on the wall, almost documentary slice of life thing, you know, and, you know, that it was just ordinary life. And this is just typical Mike Lee, isn't it? I've seen loads of Mike Lee films and they're just very, very similar. And this is another one of them. And it was not great and it was not terrible. It was in the middle. I'm giving it 5. Gareth.
All right. I found it to be that absolute slice of life, really just taken out. And you know, it's kind of shocking to get into this because it's not your standard narrative that you would expect now with a start, middle, and end. It really is properly a slice where, you know, things are happening just as you you join them and you leave them. There wasn't really a big dramatic climax or anything like that. It was just, you know, tomorrow's just another day and it's going to be something similar to today. But it really reminded me of just how different times are and how you can never really say that, you know, we're worse off than we were during the early 80s, you know, Thatcher's Britain and all that. Things are so much better now. The quality of life and opportunities for people are so much better now than what we're seeing here. Of course, there are exceptions to that, but it's just a real quality difference, and you couldn't imagine anyone from now tolerating the life that the people were having to live back then in these estates, and how there was no future for some of them. Like Gary Oldman's character of Coxie is just so depressing as to where he's going to end up, because he's completely clueless. He's got no education, and he is just he's a man child. You see him rolling about in a bin or something like that on the street, just for a laugh, just for any form of thrill. And it really, it depressed me for the entire runtime. Tim Roth's performance is absolutely superb. And you know he's just tapped into that kid you knew in school who was a real mouth breather, and he had bunged up nose and had broken glasses. And
was that kid in my class? I couldn't get over it. I thought, is that Peter? It really unsettled me, because that fella had, my classmate died recently under very tragic circumstances, and it was just took me right back to him. It was unbelievably, it was nearly spookily similar.
I did feel that. I knew someone who was like that in school myself, and a lot of people may say it was me who was like that. You never know. But, you know, everyone, even Alfred Molina's character of John,
who seems great
up there, you know, and he's got his car and he's got a nicer house than most of the other people, and, you know, he's got his work, but his wife has been denied everything, and, you know, he's got his own problems coming out of this as well, and his wife's turning into an alcoholic because of his actions. And, you know, there's nothing for anyone. It's really depressing.
Is that the first Mike Leifert's film you've seen?
No, I've seen a few others, but I haven't seen one in a long time, and I haven't seen one that's quite like this, really. But I would say that I did enjoy it, but I couldn't wait for it to be over, to rejoin my own life.
Yeah.
And I was watching it on my big TV and thinking about them watching the crap on their crappy wee TV. And
the wee ciggies smoking and smell of the fry coming in.
The HP sauce sitting on the table.
And the window falling out.
It was really depressing, and it was, you know, but it felt like it was going to have something going about it, like a happy ending or some way out of it for just one of the characters. And there wasn't really. And Alan, what you're saying, where there was that wee redeeming factor, I was thinking, was it really redeeming, or, you know, is that as good as it gets?
Yeah, I think what I loved about it was that it was so unflinchingly unsentimental. It was absolutely starkly cruel in the way it just observed how mean family can be to each other, how demeaning, you know, this kind of competition for affection and the simmering resentments that have gone on for decades. You know, it was a very, very uncomfortable watch. And then any little moments of tenderness or affection then, you know, seem monumentally consequential when they actually come. So at the end, for me, that, you know, the couple of little moments where you saw that his brother really did love him and did care for him, and there was a kind of genuine fraternal bond there, really meant so much. But nobody was riding off into the sunset or getting the girl or, you know, saving. It's not a movie with big plot dynamics in any shape or form. But the other thing about it was that it was brilliantly funny. There's a great scene where the camera stays locked off just at the front of a washing machine. and you just see the legs of the people interacting with the washing machine, trying to get this thing to work. And I just thought, that is so brilliantly and boldly staged, and yet it never feels pretentious.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, that's already dented from where it's been kicked before, and it's just getting the same treatment that it got before because it wasn't doing well.
Very nice. Is everyone still here? Oh,
no. Yes. Can you hear us?
Can you hear me okay?
I think we had a bit of a glitch there.
In the Matrix.
Had you finished what you were saying, Gareth?
Yep. And it depends on whether or not Alan was actually speaking. It depends on what has been recorded. So some folks may have heard me. Some folks may have heard Alan.
Yes.
I was just... Do you want to just... Are you happy to power on, Ted?
Yeah, definitely. Was there anything else you wanted to say about it, Alan?
Very quickly, some moments of absolute terror. I thought the scene when Gary Oldman goes around to the girl's house and starts jumping on the sofa, I find so disturbing. It was really scary because you just had no... It was so convincing and it was so bizarre, like somebody would behave in that manner. It would throw you completely and actually be genuinely terrifying. You wouldn't know what to do. And the other scene I thought was very disturbing is also when they're playing pool down in the pub, and then Gary Oldman starts to kind of butt mate with, you know, the rather slow figure. The slower brother, played by Tim Roth. And it was just a kind of feeling of such instability and freakish kind of uncontrollable quality that Oldman had. It's a bit like in Goodfellas when Joe Pesci says, you know, what am I? I'm here to amuse you. You just don't know what's going to happen next. And it's very, very unnerving. So anyway, Ted, I totally agree with you about the music. It's really wonderful. Such a bold, unusual choice, and you wouldn't think that it works at all, and yet it has this just wonderful quality, nearly magical, that it brings to this utterly dismal, banal, concrete wasteland that they live in.
Odd choice, so, isn't it? Yeah,
it was really good. I loved it. I'm going to give it a 9.
Oh, wow. Okay. I think we've got 20 there then. So that puts it in the top half of our leaderboard and in the company of the pale blue eye, three body problem, and the contra. I'm trying to name the things I can remember. Mr. Bates versus the post office. There you go.
Cool. Happy days.
So, yeah, very good. And, yeah, good choice. It certainly generated some conversation and a different thing to normal. Okay, my pick for the next show is going to be The Lost Bus, which is an Apple TV. Apparently, Apple TV is dropping this Plus thingy. I don't know if anyone saw that going through. But this Apple, which I think is a really good idea. I can't see why the Plus is on there, really. But anyway, Apple TV.
Yeah.
The Lost Bus, it's a story about the campfire in 2018 where this fire rages through parts of America, and true story, it's basically a survival drama, and it looked from the trailer as though it might be quite good, and so I thought we would challenge each other by watching that one and seeing how school teachers deal with saving children, etc. There you go. You can
excellent.
Watch that for next time. In the meantime, let's go back to Alan and talk about your themed treats choice of director.
I thought we could have a look at a little known director by the name of Alfred Hitchcock. So, Ted, you kick us off.
Oh, okay. My favourite Alfred Hitchcock film is Dial M for Murder, I think. Without any question, I think it's a great story, great film, wonderfully acted, and brilliantly staged. I think it was also done on the stage, and it's quite claustrophobic because it's all in one room. Well, it's not all in one, but almost all in one room. And it's a story of this guy who pays this other hood to bump his missus off, and cooks up this intricate plan to make it all work so no one gets caught and she gets killed, and that's the end of it. Of course, it goes wrong, and then we get the stuck-up British inspector jumping in on the scene, who has to try and put it all together, and it's just really interesting. It's a really, really good film. Thoroughly enjoy it. And my other one is Rear Window. I think we've spoken about Rear Window on the
fabulous
on the show before, and it's really, really good in film at every turn. Really, it's very different to Dial M for Murder. It's not a kind of murder mystery, but it's a suspenseful mystery about some stuff going on and
what middle-aged man who peers around through the window of his attractive young neighbours. It's kind of, I don't think it's going to age well.
So those
keeping Tom, isn't he?
Those are my two picks, but I have written quite a lot on my blog about Hitchcock films, so I'll put links into the show notes for Spellbound, Rope, The Man Who Knew Too Much. I also wrote a piece about Alfred Hitchcock and James Stewart working together and what they'd done in tandem. And I also, when Gareth gave me the Psycho 1988 nod to watch, I then watched that and compared it with the original Hitchcock one. So I'll put, 1998 is it? I'll put the link to that in the show notes as well. So yeah,
it's a waste of space, that second one. It adds nothing to the original bar a masturbation scene, which it could have done without.
we spoke at length about it at the time, and I thought Anne Heche was really good, and Julianne Moore was very good. I think the two females were better than the females in the original, frankly. But anyway, we talked about that before. So
imagine if that became a fad. If they started remaking other films and adding masturbation scenes to them, you know, just scene for scene, but throw in a masturbation scene. Right, let's get the Muppet movie out and masturbation.
Arnie scene. Walks off and says, "I'll be back." but give me 15 minutes.
So my two picks are Dial M for Murder, which I absolutely love, and everyone must watch it at least once, and Rear Window.
Dial M for Masturbate.
And Rear Window, which I would say just ditto, really. Those two films, I think, stand out in Hitchcock's platter of films, which is just phenomenal. One other one I also reviewed, and we'll put a link in the show notes to it, is one that you picked, Alan.
Oh, thank you. Yes, Strangers on a Train, 1951. So Ted's reviews there. Oddly enough, I had written my dissertation on that when I was doing film and literature. And so you mentioned there about Dial M for Murder being where somebody employs somebody else to do their murder for them. And it's the same sort of premise for Strangers on a Train. Farley Granger plays a young tennis star who's in a loveless marriage, would ideally like to get out of it, bumps into some lunatic who says, well, why don't we swap murders? I've got somebody I want to get rid of. Of course, they meet on a train, coincidentally. And fate brings them together. And this sort of very dominant, maverick, coercive character says to Farley Granger, look, I'll do your murder and you can do mine. And essentially this ludicrous conversation unfolds. And they say, well, look, there'd be nothing to connect us. There'd be no motive. So it would be a quid pro quo and it's the perfect crime. So the conversation, as I say, just, you know, manages to fill a couple of hours of boredom for them. And Farley Granger gets off and thinks, right, well, what a space cadet. But pass the time. And then he gets a phone call saying, it's me. I killed your wife. Now you've got to take up your side of the bargain and kill mine. So it's you can imagine then like the predicament he's in. and he cannot extricate himself from it. He can't report it to the police and so on. Great, great movie, just brilliantly performed, you know, masterpiece direction, and terrific stuff. And it's really engaging. I thoroughly recommend it. Obviously, I'm sure there's been many attempts to remake it, but the original is just great. And it's the opening sequence is great as well, because it just focuses on the shoes of the two main characters walking. So cross-cutting between the two main characters, getting out of the cab, outside the train station, walking across the concourse of the train station, down the platform, onto the train, down the train carriage, and eventually under the table as he sits down, he touches the shoe of the other person who's there randomly, and that, oh, I'm terribly sorry, sparks off the initial conversation that ultimately leads to the whole conflagration. And it's just great stuff. So, oh, the other one I would mention is Vertigo. It's James Stewart. But it's such a dark, dark, kind of haunting movie. It's really wonderful. And the score by Bernard Herrmann is terrific. And the sort of femme fatale of the whole thing is Kim Novak, I think. And yeah, she's utterly gorgeous in it, like breathtakingly fall in love, beautiful. So that's a much darker film than some of the other ones. Gareth, you're going to talk about one which I love, which is much lighter in tone, but Vertigo is the kind of the darkest of them, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm just going to bring up, because I watched it, I got the 4K of it 6 weeks ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. I sat and watched it with my son one Saturday night with Coke and crisps and things, and it was North by Northwest, which is one of the greatest action films ever made. It's utterly thrilling in every way, with Cary Grant just being cool as get out, and James Mason being also as cool as get out. Everything about that movie is just
Martin
cool.
Landau.
Martin Landau as well, yeah.
And who's, what do you call the girl? Gosh, Eva Marie Saint.
That's the one, yes.
Oh, holy smokes, man.
And, you know, I always think that the iconic plane chase is longer than it is. I think it's just because it is so thrilling. Yes. Whenever it happens, you just imagine it's like this big spectacle action sequence, but it's only a couple of shots. And you're away.
The build up to it's better. It's so beautifully. The build up is so good.
On the empty road, and yeah, it is. And whenever you've seen it before, and you're like, oh, this is it. We're going to get this big action sequence, and it's over in a couple of minutes. But you always think, wow, that's such a big thing going in. You know, it's like that. It's like the last half of a Bond movie or something. I mean, it's just wall to wall action, but it's not too short. I think North by Northwest, I don't think has any mistakes in it. I think it's absolutely perfect the way it is. And any mistakes that do exist, like the kid covering his ears to muffle the sound of the gunshot before it happens, actually adds to the charm of it. And you just get to know the film so well with all any guffs. And when Hitchcock makes his cameo, it just becomes so friendly and enjoyable, because everyone has a great time watching this and has a great memory of the first time they saw it and who they saw it with and all that, because it's one of those films.
And it's so erotic, like that seduction scene when they're having dinner together and you know, and he lights a cigarette and they're charming each other, and she's so unbelievably sexy, but as a classy, beautiful woman, not in a vulgar kind of way. And they just go back to her room and climb up into the bunk together. And then Hitchcock does the old joke of the train going into the tunnel, which, you know, if it was anybody else, you'd just kind of like giggle or go, oh, come on, that's so cheesy. But it's genuinely super sexy and romantic all at once. It's hard to hit that note, I think. It's just terrific.
Yeah, and the fact that it's so cool that his mother is involved so much as well.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things that, you know, anytime they bring in the mother, it really feels stupid or comedically woeful, like stop her mouth.
Yeah, it's kind of farcical, especially because he's such a kind of suave, you know, leading man, and he's still got a mummy, sort of call home. It's great. And it's a beautiful looking film, like the art direction, the suits, the people, everything, the cars, the locations.
The climax looked really well, the fight on Mount Rushmore.
Yes.
The effects still hold up, and especially in 4K. They look good, which they look better than a lot of films that came, you know, 30 or 40 years afterwards.
I can well believe it. Anyway, that was good. Any closing thoughts?
Did you...
I wanted to go back to what Ted mentioned about Rear Window. And I can never get through a conversation about Rear Window without making a recommendation. And there's a little film called Abominable, which is Rear Window. But instead of I suppose there is a murder, but it's by a Bigfoot, a Sasquatch. And Matt McCoy does his best Jimmy Stewart impression, where he's watching the ladies in a cabin opposite him, cavorting around, and then ultimately getting destroyed by a hominoid. So I'd recommend checking out Abominable.
It sounds
it
great.
It does it really well. It's got Lance Henriksen as well, and Paul Gleason, and it's directed by Lalo Schifrin's son, I think it is, and Lalo Schifrin does the soundtrack to it, so it's got everything going for it, and it's worth watching.
It does sound wretched, but when you tell me the caliber of people involved, I'd have to kind of reappraise that. Remember you tell me, just on the kind of Bigfoot thing, to watch, and perhaps we watched it together, quite possibly, The Man Who Shot Hitler and Then the Bigfoot.
Oh, yes, that's right.
That was excellent. I was expecting that to be just a rubbish, throwaway exploitation piece of trash. It was a really, really good film.
Up until this protracted ending.
Yeah, I think there was a
number of people who watched it after me and said it was really, really terrible, because I think I gave it Film of the Year.
Yeah, no, I thought it was an excellent little gem. There you go.
Alan, going back to Strangers on a Train, when you did your dissertation, did you read Patricia Highsmith's book? Because there was an interesting thing that Hitchcock did with two versions of the film, where I think it was the UK version that introduced this whole homoerotic thing in the train when they first met, and it was very different. There was extra scenes, and the USA version, they chopped them out, I think, but it's all based on her book. Did you cover that when you did it?
I remember the head of the department talking a little bit about some of the subtext in it. My dissertation was pretty rubbish, and I was down in the pub or doing plays or things most of the time. So I didn't really do very good work. But nonetheless, I must have seen the film 15, 20 times at the time. And yes, there was definitely a kind of pretty boy kind of thing with Farley Granger, and slightly kind of effeminate, handsome young man. And then the other guy definitely had a slight, you know, overtones about him as well, that you could feel that he was appraising Farley Granger with some relish, you could say.
Yeah, it's interesting that they stripped it out, though, for the USA release.
Yes, no, it's very, very interesting. Yeah. And certainly any subtext like that would not have been lost on Hitchcock, clearly. Mm-hmm. So he would have had all the kind of nuances very, very well thought through.
We could talk all night on Hitchcock, because there's so much to say. Hopefully we can jump back into it, backwards and forwards, as we go and through the shows that are coming up. And we have already covered quite a few bits of it in past shows, so it won't be lost. Let's move on. The director I'm going to choose for the next show is going to be Roman Polanski.
Very good.
With a really good kind of back catalogue of really interesting films. I was looking through it, and there's lots of stuff that I've never seen, I wasn't aware of in there, as well as the famous stuff. So lots of scope to do that indeed. Right, the main feature. Let's start with Gareth.
Who, me?
That's you.
Okay.
With a G.
All right. I have to scroll all the way down these show notes to try and find what I'd added in after Ted's. There we go. That's me there. All right. Well, the first one I'm going to go with is, well, because I've got two, and they're both new films as opposed to revisiting stuff. The Naked Gun. Now, yay. I know everyone had their reservations about this remake. Well, it's it, but technically, I think it should be reclassed as a sequel because it references the first three films and the TV series that came before it. The Naked Gun 2025, which stars Liam Neeson and Pamela Anderson and Paul Walter Hauser, is directed by Avika Schaefer and written by a team of people who front-load the film with some really good jokes. And I think you can see where I'm going to go with this now. The first, I'd say it's pretty even, actually. The first half of it is really quite funny. There's a lot of, I wouldn't say laugh-out-loud moments, but then I would even say that The Naked Gun and The Police Squad, I don't think you would laugh-out-loud. Well, no, you would. Yeah, The Police Squad, you would.
Police Squad,
The Naked Gun movies, you probably would chuckle a bit. And I did chuckle a bit at this for a while.
Did you chortle at any point?
I did chortle twice.
Okay,
and
right, well, that's good.
As well.
Yeah.
But then I gave that up in the second half as things just got a wee bit too chaotic for my own liking. And, you know, the plot gets installed. And, you know, Danny Houston is a terrific actor, and he's perfect for the villain of a Naked Gun movie. But whenever the whole storyline starts happening, it becomes a bit tiresome, and the gags start to falter. I know that obviously Leslie Nielsen would have had a cameo had he still been with us, but they try to invoke him through an owl, you know, like a hooting flying thing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of frustrating because I would have preferred for them not to have had him in any reference to him because he's not here to say whether or not he liked it.
Is it supposed to be like a spirit totem or something, or?
Yeah.
What's the idea of that? Right. Yeah.
Oh, and it's very much played out and explained why he's coming back as an owl.
Okay.
Because Liam Neeson's character has a moment where he explains that. Priscilla Presley is the one thing that really, I find it so bizarre. She's in the film, but she's in one shot. And I've got a funny feeling that perhaps they had more and decided to cut her out, but left one shot in, which doesn't make any sense. It's got no introduction, and only people who know who she is going to go, oh, right, there's Frank Drebin Jr.'s mother sitting watching TV. And it doesn't make sense for the cameo. And it should have required an introduction or, you know, give her a line or something. It really felt just maybe a last-minute installation of, yeah, well, we could get her in. She's not doing anything. She's just sitting on the couch at the moment. We'll send a camera crew around and film her doing that.
Yeah, so it didn't constitute a proper cameo?
No, it didn't. And I think that's happening more and more. It's like The Fall Guy. The cameos from Lee Majors and Heather Thomas at the end of that film were...
Oh, yes,
were
that's right. They were
kind of insulting. You know, they should have been in the film a lot more than what they were.
That was not a good movie.
No, it was all right, I suppose. I didn't mind it. But, you know...
I rest my case. It's all right, I suppose. Therefore, is not a good movie. Am I right?
Yeah. But Liam Neeson makes this watchable. And I was thinking about what other actors they could have actually brought in to play this role. Mm-hmm. And the more I think about it, the more I'm happy that they got Liam Neeson to do it because he suits this.
I think he's a great choice for it. Yeah.
He's such an intense actor, and he doesn't do comedy very often. He hasn't tried to do comedy. You know, if they had brought I don't know, De Niro or Pacino in or something like that. They have tried comedy, and you know, one of them's quite good at it, the other's fucking not. And that's Pacino's not good at the comedy side of things.
He's not a comic actor particularly, no.
No, he's not. But Liam Neeson has shown, and this gives him a good area to move into, a bit like Leslie Nielsen. He spent most of his career playing the heavy, playing the more dramatic roles until he did Airplane.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of works for Liam Neeson to be able to retire from the action movies into comedies. That would work quite nicely. Pamela Anderson is terrific. I've always said that she is a very solid actress. I know other people will disagree with me, but I find her to be absolutely...
I won't. No, I won't. I mean, what was the one we watched recently? She was terrific in.
The Last Showgirl?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Ted that really that doesn't quite like her, isn't it?
Right. Oh, right, right, okay.
This sort of thing suits her very well. And I would say that she's done spoof movies before because of who she is. But here they get away from that and they treat her as a proper actress. And I prefer that. And she does really well. Paul Walter Hauser is completely underused. And the one thing that really confused me was in the trailer. You've all seen the trailer, and there's that sequence where they're going along, and Liam Neeson speaks to his dad on the wall. Walter Hauser speaks to his dad on the wall, and then you've got Moses Jones sitting down to talk to his dad on the wall, who's Nordberg, played by O.J. Simpson, and he gives the camera that look.
Right.
And his character's only in it for that one scene. I thought he was going to be a larger character throughout the entire movie, but he's not. He's there for that gag and that gag alone. And that made me a wee bit annoyed. But, you know, it just feels like they're looting the jokes for the sake of the jokes and not actually, you know, interweaving it into the film. The other big problem I have is the gag at the end of The Police Squad, every episode they do the laugh and they look into the air and they're going, hey!
Yeah,
and
they just, do fake freeze frame.
Yeah, they freeze themselves and the coffee's still pouring and people are still moving about in the background. They do that in the film. And then they enter into it. You know, they decide to go one further, and that didn't sit well with me. That was a really poor gag where they try to expand on something so simple,
right?
And it annoyed me. And I it was that moment I was like, I don't want them to make a sequel to this at all, unless they get someone who's really really good. Because you know the jokes were just getting lesser and lesser as the film went on, and it felt more like. Started out watching Naked Gun and ended up with Spy Hard.
Oh dear, dear.
So I think I gave it about 6 out of 10 in the end because, you know, I had that hope for it, but it just did so many things wrong that I don't want to see another one. And I've been checking today and I don't believe there's a sequel on the slate yet. However, it's done so well at the box office that I think a sequel's inevitable. At this stage,
and it'll
probably be a lazy one as well, because that one was considered good. So they can do a lazy one next, and then do a good one after that to get people back into the cinema.
Yeah,
so that's a bit of a shame. Have either of you two seen The Naked Gun?
No, I haven't. I heard kind of mixed reports, and I haven't got round to it. I think I would watch it on telly at some point. I'm actually not that fussed on the Naked Gun films, bar the first one, and I love Police Squad. Police Squad can do no wrong, essentially. So I'm happy to kind of leave it, like so many things, unsullied, you know, by the more recent stuff.
Ted?
Yeah, me too. Echo what Alan said, really. It doesn't particularly blow my socks off, but when it comes round and it's included with some viewing thingy, and I've got an afternoon or whatever, I shall certainly watch it and have a look.
Fair dues. All right. Well, the next one I want to talk about is Well, it's actually a return to another franchise as well. So it's in the same league as the Naked Gun. And I would say that I enjoy this one a wee bit more. Not a huge amount more, but it's enough. And this is called Final Destination Bloodlines. Now, I'm not going to try and say that I've seen all of the Final Destination movies. I've seen some of them. I've seen one and two and two other ones, but I don't know which ones they are. I haven't revisited.
And it says it all, doesn't it?
Well, it's a return to a solid franchise. I don't remember anyone ever saying that one of them was terrible. I've only ever heard people saying, oh, they're class, they're great fun, and I can get behind it. I understand why they're great fun, and I enjoy them as well. And I just have never got around to watching all of them.
Yeah.
And I can't remember which ones I did go to see, because I'm not 50 yet, but I'm getting there. I'm in my early, mid to late 50s, 40s even. That'll do. it's quite clever the way this works things, and it works things so effectively because the rules of the universe have already been established by the, I don't know, eight or so movies that come before this. And this film doesn't have to spend any amount of time explaining what those rules are because it knows the audience is back and they've already probably seen those. So it does the minimal amount of explanation and exposition to tell you what's going on. It also has become very effective at getting over the drama of people who lose their loved ones through the plots of these films, because these films are about people who narrowly avoid dying in some sort of big accident and how they spend the rest of the film avoiding the Grim Reaper, who never appears, but the Grim Reaper who's out to get them through a series of increasingly silly ways to die. It's like the opening of Casualty, where you know, you see a woman walking into the kitchen and turning on the gas ring on her thing and setting a kettle on top of it to bring it to the boil. And then whenever the kettle starts to whistle, the steam pushes a knife off the shelf.
And she's
into her eye and she dies like that instead of like a house fire. So you're expecting one thing, something else happens that kills the person in that way. Yeah. You know, it's just that bonkers little collection of creative creations that they put in to kill people, and that's what people are looking for when they watch this. So, you know, where you know someone's father is being chewed up by a lawnmower or something like that, or thrown out of the top of a hotel or something like that. You know, you don't get time for any form of remorse. It's like, oh no, it's my turn next. Quickly, we're going to have to do everything we can to prevent me from dying. And so,
yeah.
And then there's another elongated murder that happens involving various different things around the house, garage, and whatever they happen to be in. The pacing in this is really snappy, and I think that's because at the expense of the drama. You know, it doesn't have to get bogged down with that, so just keep going at it. And there's a lot of humor in it as well. There's a decent amount of dark humor. There's some annoying teenagers, and you know they kind of get annoying in a way because you know us older people find it difficult to tolerate new young people and the way they do their things.
Well,
but the lead girl, I think her name was it Stephanie or something like that? Yeah, she was really quite enjoyable, and she held it all quite well. I think it's a challenge to an actress to be able to go through all of these dramatical shifts and be able to keep things together and see each of the characters disappear off one by one. Tony Todd, who was in, I don't know, three or four of the previous movies, who passed away soon after this movie was released, has a beautifully touching exit from the film. It's almost like they knew this is going to be the last thing he does. I think he did a computer game afterwards, but so that doesn't really count. Mm. But this was him leaving the silver screen. And walking out, there was a wee bit of a tear in my eye because I do love Tony Todd and his contribution to cinema right from The Night of the Living Dead all the way up to this. is incredible. But yeah, he was there for a couple of scenes, and I loved seeing him there, as unhealthy as he looked. There's going to be a sequel to this. There's got to be, because it did so well, got good reviews, and I think it cleaned up at the box office. So I'll welcome another installment, and I'll probably go back and try and catch up on those ones that I've missed. But I'd recommend other people do as well, because they're just silly fun, and you know, it even lampoons itself whenever one of the characters works out how these killings happen. And they start, you know, trying to avoid things, and going, well, what do you mean try to avoid things? And she went, well, this could happen and that could happen. You could end up being thrown into that garbage truck over there. And then, you know, things happen, and it happens in a slightly different way. And the person ends up in a garbage truck. It's like, right, okay. You know, it has that sense of humor about it. And it's designed.
That's also what's scary. So after you, sorry.
No, that you can just sit down in a group of people and have a laugh with this. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah. That's what's kind of like funny about it is like, but it's also the scary thing about it is that it, like in a Greek tragedy, the more you try and escape your fate, the more you fall victim to it. So yeah. it works well. Yeah.
I know it makes you think as well, you know, there's certain things that you do. Maybe you're out in the garden shed and you're going to go, right, okay, I'm going to try and I can't quite reach it, but I'm going to go and get that bit of sandpaper over there. I'll try and reach it, and you position something to make yourself a wee bit closer, and you're thinking, yeah, is this a final destination thing? If I overlook the toothpaste, yes, in the bathroom, that's going, yeah, to squidge out, that cause this to move and then that to blow, yeah, open, and the, yeah, and then I'm going to kill myself and impale myself on
fall into the shark tank just as the laser, yeah, rips through your body. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's superb fun. It's not the best movie ever made. Hitchcock never made one of these, but Ted, I imagine you like these sorts of films. You get a bit of a scream out of them, don't you?
I've never seen one of them. I don't think I have. How far do they go back in terms of years? When do they start making them?
Oh, was it your man Devin Sawyer? He was in the first one whenever he was a kid. 2000 was the first one.
I was just going to say, but okay. 25 years, something like that.
Right, yeah.
Oh, there's only six of them? This is the sixth one? Right, okay. I must be thinking of The Fast and the Furious. So then I've seen four.
2000 would have been after my heyday of dipping into such genres. When I was in the 1980s, when I was doing my psyche nurse training, we used to watch all sorts of video nasties and dreadful films, and that would have been my time to kind of probably get into something like this, such as I did with I Spit on Your Grave, Slinky Link. I decided this fortnight, or this month as it turns out, to try and watch all this I Spit on Your Grave films. And for those who are uneducated, like I was until Gareth guided me, there was the original in 1978. There was a remake of the original in 2010. Then there was a part two of the remake in 2013. Then there was a part three of the same actor in the lead in 2015. Then there was a fourth one, which was Deja Vu.
And that was the sequel to the 78 one.
Was it? Right, yeah, okay. Yes, that's, yeah, right. Because in the in the Deja Vu one, the only thing that was good about it really was that they had got all the original characters from the first film and brought them back in, yeah, one shape, form or another. And they explained in Deja Vu who was what, and there were actually some surprises there which I hadn't really thought through from the first film. So as you come to the end of the Deja Vu, the fourth one, you start to say, oh yeah, of course, and oh right, that's so and so, and that's, and it all kind of fits together, even down to the very last scene when two people drive up in a car, and then you suddenly realise that they were the two children of the central woman who's doing the ridiculous stuff in the Deja Vu film. Apart from that, the Deja Vu film was just ludicrously long. It was an hour too long. It was 2.5 hours. I can't believe that I stuck it out. And it was just, yeah, and it's just so badly acted from the whole cast. Even, you know, the original actor that played in the 1978 film, I can't remember her name,
Keaton.
Yeah, so she had she made an appearance too for a while in the film. The plot was that she'd written a book about her appearance. Sorry, she'd written a book about her experience in the 1978 story, in which she had been brutally raped and tortured by these four hoodlums in this kind of outback, dusty Southern American place somewhere. And she had taken out her revenge on these people. Now, the revenge is the second half of the film. The first half of the film is what happens to her, and the second half of the film, in gory, violent detail, is what she does to them to take her revenge. In the jumping back to the deja vu, we see her written a book about her experiences, and then the people that were the characters who were the relatives of the people in the first film who she'd taken out revenge on come back to then take out revenge on her and her daughter. And the daughter, it turns out, has got a significant link with the story as well, which I won't spoil for anyone. But it's a bonkers plot. It's really badly acted in that fourth one. I think that the second one was the best one. So the remake of the first one, I think that the 1978 one had its own charm. It felt quite dated, though. I say charm, I mean, it's very gory, and charm probably isn't a word you should use with this kind of story, but it felt very dated.
Creation thing springs to mind. That's a word.
Yeah. So in the 2010 one, I think that it was better. It was better played, I think, and it was more it was pulled together well. It was better produced in many ways, and also the violent way in which she got back at them, which is not exactly the same as the first film. For one thing, they introduce a cop. So in the first film, there's not a cop. In the second, in the remake, there's a cop, a fifth person, a fifth male who, at the beginning, we think is, you know, coming to rescue her, and it turns out that he's as bad as the four guys, and so much raping and torturing goes on, and then she takes her revenge. And actually, the ways in which she takes her revenge in the second film, I think, is better and better done and more inventive and just has more impact, I think, in the second half of the film than the first one. The third one, which is I Spit in Your Grave 2, is the same character, but she's gone to New York. And this is possibly the second worst one of the lot, I think. She goes to New York. Again, she gets tortured and raped and all the rest of it. And then she escapes and then takes revenge on them again. I mean, basically, all these films are kind of the same story, really, and they just couched it slightly differently. And they each of them have their own good points and bad points, but this third one feels much more like a made-for-TV film. And the central character, Katie, she goes to try and get a modeling job in New York. It just doesn't really work very well. And the third one, Vengeance Is Mine, 2015, again, it's all just very far-fetched. She's attending therapy by this time in a rape victim group. And then she starts turning into Dexter because she goes and listens to all these girls that have been rape victims and goes vigilante and starts killing these people that are responsible for being nasty to these girls. So, you know, it's all a bit. As they've gone on, I think they've just got worse and worse and worse. And the last one, apart from the interesting bits about the deja vu one, I mean, apart from the interesting bits about pulling the strings together and smartly kind of rounding up the 1978 original film, just really badly made, badly acted by everyone, just rubbish. It really is poor, and 2.5 hours long. Then I watched, I thought I'd watch the documentary, which is Growing Up With I Spit On Your Grave, and that's out there as well. You can watch that. And that all that is really is a documentary. They take the actors from the original film, the 1978 one, and they just put them in front of a camera and they start talking to them about their experience when they were making the film, and it, frankly, it just bored me shitless because it was just boring. You know, they were just giving little anecdotes about what was what, and actually, all us actors who played in the 78 film, we all love each other really, and we're all just great. And you know, and they were talking a bit about the insights into whether or not this kind of film should be made, et cetera. So those were the five films. Then there was another one which I stumbled into called Savage Vengeance, and that was the worst film ever made, along a very similar theme, really. Very, very similar theme, but it felt, Alan, as though, you know, like it was a Larmageddon, really, a bunch of students that really low budget, dreadful sound, for example, fuzzy director video footage, diabolical acting, and so on. Nothing positive at all to say about this. Although, you would say, Alan, at least they had a go at doing something.
True. But sometimes you think, well, they should have had a go at doing something else.
Yeah, exactly.
Like cleaning out the shed, or.
But Gareth, you're much more knowledgeable about this bunch of films than me. So do tell me what I've missed and where I've gone wrong, and what you agree with or disagree with.
Well, it's a franchise that it's been a while. It was one of those films. The original was one of those films that you had to find and you had to see. And I remember getting involved in all the background information about it, the rumors and things like that, because it was not easy to find, and because it came under a couple of titles as well. There was Day of the Woman and I Hate Your Guts. And then eventually it came out as I Spit in Your Grave, but you could sometimes find it under those other titles if you looked hard enough in video libraries and things. But I remember, and I can't find anything about this now, but I remember there was an urban legend that the film originally did have five guys in it, not four. And I'm thinking that the fifth guy was maybe the police officer that they reworked in for the remake.
Yeah.
But they cut that character out completely because of, I don't know, because he was a policeman or something like that. Or the rumors were, you know, what happens to him is so nasty that it would never get released. But it wasn't getting released anyway, so it might have just all been crap at the time.
Marketing. So. Might have been a marketing trick.
Yeah. And there was also the woman on the cover with the torn leotard or whatever it is she's wearing, running with a knife. That might be Demi Moore.
Oh, right.
That might be one of her first roles, or first modeling role. And I'm just looking to see if I can find someone saying that somewhere. But I remember reading that years ago and trying to work out which poster it is and that. But she was the model used on the advertising stuff. But it is an interesting film to find. It's kind of an upsetting film for anyone to sit down and watch. If they're in a cheery mood, you got to ask yourself why you're actually watching this. You know, or is this here to entertain you or to thrill yourself or what? Are you just looking for a little bit of nudity? Which I know whenever I was about 14 or 15 and trying to find this, that's pretty much what it was. But the sequels were, I remember the remake that came out in 2010. I think that came off of the back of the remake of Straw Dogs, and it was done quite well. So
film.
It was, yeah. But James Woods was in the remake of Straw Dogs, and right. it did really well at the box office, and the critics were quite impressed by it. So I think they'd try it again, or it might be the other way around. This one came out and it did quite well. So, you know, there were two fairly strong remakes of Video Nasties back in the day. But the two that came after were obviously direct-to-video sequel follow-up things, you know, done cheap as possible to maximise on a popular IP. The girl that's in Deja Vu, Jimmy Bernadette, she was the girl who was in that End Times we watched. You remember that sci-fi movie?
Which one?
The sci-fi movie we watched on our featured film. Private Screening.
End Times.
Where they... she goes and lives in a strange, she was
the daughter. Oh, here it is, End Times. I've got my cursor on it there, so if anyone...
She was the lead in that.
Okay.
Let me go to that.
Yeah. I knew I'd seen her somewhere before, and it's obviously from this. Mm. But she's actually a fairly decent actress. I'd say she was
really good in End Times. Yeah,
she was. Yeah, and I think it doesn't translate too well to maybe the I spit in your grave Deja Vu, because it just maybe wasn't handled particularly well and didn't make the most of her performance whenever they were maybe editing it or something or putting it all together. It's an interesting series of films. And Savage Vengeance was really difficult to find. It's only an hour long, memory serves. I haven't seen it in a long time, but it was shot on VHS and edited between two VHS machines or VCRs. It suffers from that because it was made on the cheap because they managed to get Camille to appear in it as Jennifer, which is unthinkable, but it's an unofficial sequel. I do think it has been released as I Spit in Your Grave 2 in certain areas. It's a murky franchise, and it just goes to show that it's a strange thing that people actually grew out of after a while, aside from Ted, who didn't watch it for many years and grown into it.
I only ever saw the first one, and going by the documentary, I clearly didn't see it in 1978 because they couldn't get it. The documentary was saying they couldn't get it produced, and it wasn't out until like a couple of years after the 78 release date, and they had to struggle hard to get someone to back it and to push it out. So I must have seen it in the 80s in my, as I say, Video Nasty days. And I haven't seen it since then. So, you know, like whatever that is, 40 years ago. I'd forgotten much about it, to be honest. And I'd never seen any of these other ones. In the documentary, they do... To be fair, they do talk about the pros and cons about whether it should be made and what the point of it is and what, you know. So, if anyone wants to analyse it a bit further, there's resources where it can be analysed. But I think you're right, Gareth. Most people would probably just leave it alone. And it's a kind of mark in time about a series of films which kind of did something on the film nasty market, and everyone's moved on from. It's just that I hadn't seen any of them for so long, and I'd only seen that first one.
Well, it's a trendsetter. But I remember it arriving on Channel 4 one night and being a bit shocked that it was being televised. And that just shows that the times were changing and content was deemed more acceptable. The whole idea that The Evil Dead became a TV show and The Exorcist became a TV show. If you traveled back in time to the time of the release and say, yeah, it'll be a TV show one day, no one would believe you.
Anyway, it was quite an interesting experience. And some of it's actually, dare I say, some of it's actually quite funny. some of the ways in which the female lead takes revenge on people, nasty and gruesome and gory as it is, sometimes I was laughing at it because it's just so absurd and ridiculous. There it is. I'm glad I've watched it all.
Isn't one of the guys of limited brain capacity? It has been a long time since I saw
in the original film
Matthew
in the original film, she almost takes pity on him but not quite, and then in the Deja Vu again that end of the story is tied up where Matthew's mum turns up and so-and-so's wife turns up and blah blah blah, and you can stitch it all together. It's actually quite well, as I say, well thought through, which is probably why it took 2.5 hours to show it.
She didn't grind them, then.
Anyway, there you go. There's one for an odd one for a while. Alan, bring us back down to ground with something.
Well, you know, after all this talk about, you know, video nasties, I Spit in Your Grave, The Exorcist, I thought we'd dip into Basil Brush from 1979, which I stumbled across ITV Retro, I think it's called, which had posted, if you recall, we were talking about the great 60s show together recently, The Prisoner.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So it's on the same channel. Anyway, Basil Brush show appeared. I watched a little bit of it and just realized how funny it was. I was crying with laughter within a minute of touching base with Al Baz again. Yeah, boom, boom. And it was great. Unfortunately, Ted, I believe you had tried to click on the link and got nowhere.
No, I think that the video has been removed from YouTube.
Yeah,
but I have provided a link to the original 1968 show on IMDb.
Oh, thank you so much. That's great. Good stuff. It really was. Did we talk about The Persuaders last time?
No,
not on the last show. No.
Okay, very good. Because moving Basil aside and his marvelous oeuvre of comedy works, we've been doing The Prisoner, and it seemed like a natural kind of like follow-on to have a look at The Persuaders with Roger Moore and Tony Curtis.
Yep.
And it's a sort of quintessential sort of 60s, late 60s, early 70s, suave, debonair rakes who go around solving crimes involving hotties and always driving really, really nice cars. It's the kind of thing that Austin Powers sort of sends up. I have never seen it, if you can believe it.
Wow.
And I've been really enjoying just how fun, vibrant, nostalgic, colourful, out of date and sexy the whole thing is. And it's just wonderful. It's just good fun, mm-hmm. and sort of stuff that we need more of. And finally, then I had a look at The Northman, which I had missed. Roger Eggers, I think it's his breakthrough feature film, correct me if I'm wrong, which is a sort of violent revenge tale for about a Viking boy who witnesses the murder of his father and then pledges himself to avenge the murder. It's very bold, I'll say that. I mean, it's perhaps a wee bit uneven. The acting's really good. The story is quite simple and stark. It's a couple of set pieces that are absolutely staggeringly accomplished and really, really good. And then there's a couple of bits that just don't really come together and they're a bit daft, I thought. And some of the visual effects were rather uneven. They seem very kind of artificial and green screeny, which undermined a lot of the elemental imagery of, you know, landscape and water and ice and blood and meat and all the kind of primal kind of visuals that were much more effective. Very strong cast. Skarsgård, the young Skarsgård, is in the lead. You've got Nicole Kidman, Willem Dafoe. And it's good. It's uneven, but it was well worth a watch. And Ted, you have seen it, I think, and you had similar thoughts, yeah?
No, not at all. The bit of feedback.
Or Gareth?
Sorry,
who was it from?
the bit of feedback we got in the recording notes was from Chad Dixon there.
Thank you, Chad. Yeah.
He said that it was not as good as I was expecting after hearing some of the positive reviews when it was in the cinema in 2022. Everyone trying to do that very odd Scandi accent first heard in the Vikings TV series is just a bit off-putting now, especially since everyone's attempt is so inconsistent that it's all over the place. The scenery and locations were stunning and everyone looked suitably cold and dirty, especially the very buffed Alexander Skarsgård in the lead. Some of the other bigger names seemed a bit wasted in the very predictable revenge plot. However, the fighting scenes were pretty good. So that was Chad. I haven't seen it, Alan, no.
Yeah. Thank you, Chad. That's well put. I wouldn't say it was very predictable insofar as there's one real spanner in the works, which is crucial, that I wasn't particularly expecting. And it really kind of opened up the film for me towards the last sort of third of the movie. But by the end of it, I thought, well, that was an interesting watch, but I wasn't emotionally involved in the film, really. So there you have it. Basil Brush is the standout. Unfortunately, we can't get him. So up for the Persuaders. In fact, when we finish tonight, I'm going to treat myself to another episode of that just have some jolly old nonsense. And it's so beautifully English. You know, it's amazing how much the country has changed in that time. But even just the footage of, London in the 70s, the beautiful cars and so on, it's just fab. Really enjoyable.
Certainly is. Yes, indeed. Right. Moving on swiftly, as we're running quite long now. Coming soon, Gareth, what have we got?
All right, we'll start with the first one here, which is a new film with Adam Sandler and George Clooney called Jay Kelly, which is about a famous movie actor called Jay Kelly, who embarks on a journey of self-discovery, confronting his past and present with his devoted manager, Ron. It's poignant and humor-filled, pitched with an intersection of regrets and glories. I put this in because I figured this is something that Ted and Alan probably like before I get into the more interesting stuff.
You cheeky rascal. You
gentlemen, look forward to this wanky looking stuff.
Looks a load of bollocks to me. American dream movie about movie makers massaging their egos and moneyed celebrities. Utter soap opera level bollocks is what I put here. However, the production values do look very good. And also, I don't know if you noticed either of you, but the music in the trailer was really nice. I don't know what it was, but they got some really nice music going on in the background. So I'll just turn away from the screen and listen to it.
That sounds good. I thought it looked like turgid, indulgent, self-congratulatory nonsense. So I think we're all on the same page. I very much love Clooney as an actor, and I think his work's fantastic. But this just looked utterly cringe.
Looked crap. Anaconda is next, which is about a group of friends who are going through a midlife crisis. They decide to remake their favorite movie from their youth and encounter unexpected events as they enter the jungle. So this has Paul Rudd and Jack Black and a bit of a kind of feel of Tropic Thunder about it, with the two of them going all crazy and stuff. Ted, you're going to hate this, aren't you?
I'm going to hate it because it's another film about people making films. For goodness sake, just make the film. Let's watch the film. I don't want to see you making the film. And Jack Black, I'm afraid, is just tedious and annoying. Alan?
I'd happily watch Jack Black being eaten by an anaconda, providing it was a real anaconda and the real Jack Black. Yeah, I'm with you. I thought, I maybe smirked at the beginning of the teaser trailer and kind of went, but halfway through the trailer, I was going, not on your Nelly.
Well, see, that's when I felt I had to put in because everyone was talking about it. So, it's a big movie. The next one is one I'm genuinely excited about, and it's called The Rip, which is not coming until January of 2026, which I suppose isn't too many months away, but it's still far enough away because I want to watch this now. It looks like my kind of cup of tea. This is about a group of Miami cops discovering a stash of millions in cash, leading them to distrust as outsiders learn about the huge Caesar, making them question who to rely on. Clumsily put together, I thought, to be honest. But it's got Ben Affleck and Matt Damon as the two leading cops who kind of go maybe head-to-head with their own paranoia about each other. And it looks like it's full of big action sequences. And if I just wrap it on for a little minute, I'll be able to look it up. Yeah, it's directed by Joe Carnahan, who is directed Narc with Ray Liotta and Smokin' Aces and Cop Shop, which we watched with Jared Butler a wee while ago. So I'm all over this. I'm really excited about this. Ted, you're not. Alan?
But a buddy cop film. Hurrah! Actually, to be fair, I mean, I've been quite negative in my comments here, but actually, to be fair, the storyline looked like it might have the makings of a half-decent thriller. It's just not my kind of genre, really. But I would give it a go. Alan?
It's not a comedy.
That's got one thing going for it, I suppose.
The curmudgeon has spoken. Yeah. But having taken the mickey out of Ted, I'm kind of on the same page. I don't see much in it that would endear me to it or to lift it out of anything that we haven't seen many, many times before. I do really like Matt Damon as an actor. Ben Affleck, I think he's good, but it doesn't really interest me. And the subject matter on the basis of the trailer just looks a bit boring. I think it doesn't seem to have a USP as far as I can see.
Okay. All right. Well, fair enough. Each their own. The Running Man is getting a remake, and it's by Edgar Wright. This is about a man who joins a game show where contestants are allowed to go anywhere in the world, but they're pursued by hunters hired to kill them. So it's a wee bit different to the way The Running Man was when Arnie did it, but it stars Glenn Powell, who seems to be everyone's favourite at the moment, Amelia Jones, and what was his name? I can't see it here. Michael Cera's in there. Josh Brolin, who looks like he's having great fun. Willem H. Macy, and I can't find your man's name, who's the host of the show. Sorry, forgot.
No, buy that for a dollar.
Wasn't that the guy in the original?
No, that was RoboCop.
RoboCop, sorry.
Yeah. I'd rather watch Squid Game.
So, well, I suppose this is another remake of an Arnie classic. They did Total Recall, and Colin Farrell remade that. And I know a lot of people give that a huge amount of hate, but I actually quite like that remake. So I'm going to give this a go, but I'm wondering if you two will. Alan, it's a bit of sci-fi hook'em.
Hook'em? 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 I don't know. Does it hook'em? I would have just said why initially, because the original one is just a classic, but then I suppose that answers its own question, doesn't it? And Edgar Wright is one of my favourite directors, so I will give this a go, and I'm sure it will probably be better than the original one, albeit that the original one is a classic timepiece. Edgar Wright knows what he's doing, 100%. So I would... Yeah. I'll definitely give this a go, yeah.
Ted, some hate?
No, just that I'd rather watch Squid Game, really. Just the whole thing just seems like dreadful nonsense to me. I don't get this kind of film. No, moving on, what's next?
Well, the actor I was looking for was Coleman Domingo, and his voice. His voice is just incredible. I love his voice. It is so smooth. Next up is... Greenland.
Yes, would you call me up in that in those husky tones later this evening, maybe about 11:30?
Undo the shipping news, yes.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Greenland Migration is the sequel to the film that should not have been as much fun as it actually was, starring Jared Berger and Marina Bakarina. about the end of the world. And they managed to make a fairly decent looking sequel out of what happened in the first one, with them coming back out of the bunker and having to repopulate the world in a non-porno way. What did you guys think of this?
I really like the first one, that Greenland, with Burger, Cheeseburger Matey. I thought it was really done well. It was a real gripping thrill ride, and really, really enjoyed it. And the time flew. We spoke about it on the show, and so I'm hoping that this one, it looks a bit different. This one, it's not so centered around him and his little family, but it broadens out the thing in terms of a global catastrophe more so, and who's behind the decision making and that sort of thing, clearly from the trailer. But this is the best thing on the menu so far tonight, I reckon. Alan?
I concur, especially about the how good the first one was, unexpectedly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good, solid thriller, yep.
Okay. I think they're running dangerously close to running out of films to make sequels out of starring Jared Berger. They've got to be careful. So, the next one is The Ballad of a Small Prayer, which stars Colin Farrell, who is laying...
Player? Yeah.
Sorry. Spending his days and nights on the casino floors, drinking heavily and gambling what little money he has left. Struggling to keep up with his fast-rising debts, he is offered a lifeline by the mysterious Dao Ming, Fala Chen, a casino employee with secrets of her own. However, in the hot pursuit, is Cynthia Blythe, Tilda Swinton, a private investigator ready to confront Doyle and what he is running. Things happen. And then the film finishes with some credits. Mm-hmm. Ted, you think this looks good, don't you?
I do, yeah, I think it does look good. I liked the look of the trailer, which was quite long, and I think that Colin Farrell looked like he was playing the part really well. I liked the look of what Tilda Swinton had turned her character into as well. I thought that looked really funny and also very sinister, and she plays a private investigator, as you say, who's after him, and he's nicked some money from someone and blah, blah, blah. And it just looked really... It looked like it was complex, but actually really interesting and well-acted and well-produced, and I'm surprised it's not on Apple-produced thing. It's on Netflix. Alan?
I thought this looked absolutely terrific and can't wait to see it. It looks like Colin Farrell's really in his A game with this. It's a phenomenal director, Edward Berger, who did, oddly enough, Berger's being a theme here, after Greenland, but he directed All Quiet on the Western Front, which was insanely good. So yeah, this looks brilliant. It looks like it's a really visual drama about an incredibly tense predicament that somebody's got himself into. I thought it looked great.
Fair news. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that looks like the most exciting film on the list, aside from Jared Berger.
Yeah.
you can have 2 out of 6 for that lot. Right, before we go, we have a final curtain, which is sadly packed. Gareth?
Okay, well, we'll start off with, and we're going to feature heavily with Ted here, because he is a big fan of Diane Keaton, who passed away at 79 just the other day. Ted, tell us about Diane Keaton.
And Alan, really, because Alan was just as much a fan of Diane Keaton,
yes.
Maybe even more so. Very sad, and it made me reflect on the, well, basically the Woody Allen films that she's been in collusion with about, and I listed them here. There's 8 of them. Play It Again, Sam, Play It Again, Sam, Sleeper, Love and Death, Annie Hall, Interiors, Manhattan Murder Mystery, which I would really like that film. I thought it was great. And the 8th one is Radio Days. I know, Alan, you were very keen on Annie Hall, but Manhattan Murder Mystery,
right.
I just thought it was the best one. I really, really enjoyed that. But yeah, tell us about Annie Hall.
It's just a beautiful love story, and it's so inventively put together. It's incredibly cinematic, and loose and free and full of creativity, and she's absolutely adorable as this kind of ditzy, beautiful young woman that she and Woody fall in love, and it's kind of like their love affair, and she's just, you couldn't help but fall in love with her. And again, with Play It Again, Sam, I just slightly melt when I see her in that, because she's kind of annoying and all over the show and neurotic and gorgeous and funny and sweet and vulnerable all at once. She's so lovely. And just such a really gifted actress, and very, very great foil for Woody as well. Yeah, I'm really, really sad that she's gone.
But also tons of other stuff, Alan. If you look
tons
through,
of other stuff, yeah.
Look through the list. There's so much more that isn't Woody Allen. She was working 2024. She's still good. Also was involved with three upcoming titles as well. And there's just tons and tons of stuff in there over the years that she's done.
Yeah.
Even laying Woody aside, Gareth.
Yeah.
Well, I know her best from the Godfather trilogy, where she plays Kay. I think I don't know too many films with her. She's not the kind of, she makes the films that I kind of shy away from, I suppose. I remember seeing her on TV playing Amelia Earhart in a film, and I can't find it for the life of me. So that's one I wanted to bring to it. Then she was in that one with Warren Beatty, Reds.
Yes. Yeah, I seem to remember that was pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. But other than that, I just, because it's all romantic comedy type things, they all fall together into the same thing. She did one with Harrison Ford called Morning Glory. That's the only standout, because Harrison Ford was in it. But otherwise, I'm not I don't know too much about her, to be honest.
And I have to say,
that one with Jack Nicholson as well. Yeah,
yeah. Something's Got to Give. I have to say that if it hadn't been for Woody Allen, I probably wouldn't have been focused at all on Diane Keaton. You know, that's what. But once you start watching her, you start to look at the. Really, really sad. I didn't realise she was 79. I thought she would have been younger than that. But we're all getting older.
Yeah, that's no two ways about it.
Well, we also lost Claudia Cardinal, who I wouldn't say is a huge name, but you've no doubt seen something that she's in, maybe Once Upon a Time in the West, or Fitzcarraldo, which I watched a wee while ago, or Fellini's 8½, or in particular, The Pink Panther, where she made such an impression on me as a child, because I adore that movie, but I particularly enjoy the scene that it switched it up. I'd never seen anything quite like it in my young eyes, where the film was just happily plodding along on its way, being funny. And then there was this musical number where they're all sitting inside this cozy little Austrian taverny type thing. And she's singing this song called Megillo Strauss. And she works her way around dancing with people and things, and she had this incredible figure, this incredible voice, and I sat open mouthed at it, and I got the video a couple of years later, and I watched it again and again. I bought the soundtrack in the hope that song was on it. I was very disappointed that it wasn't, and I don't think it actually has been released on a soundtrack for that film. I have a number of them now, and it's never been there. But yeah, she's an incredible actress, especially from Once Upon a Time in the West, used by many of the greats, Leone and Fellini and Werner Herzog, not to mention Blake Edwards, and beautiful to boot. You know, obviously you guys know that, and I put a link in for that little song in the show notes on YouTube.
I don't know the song, But Once Upon a Time in the West, she was just so incredibly beautiful. I haven't seen the Pink Panther movie. 8.5. I know. 8.5 is one of my all-time favorites. It just knocked me sideways. And Fitzcarraldo is a masterpiece as well. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. Oh, well, what's the wee YouTube video later on? Because you can see David Niven sitting in the background, Peter Sellers in the background, Robert Wagner. Wow. And she's just singing away. And I think it's done in maybe two takes. It looks like somewhere, it's where you want to be right now, is sitting in that room with them, drinking a stein of beer, eating some sauerkraut and some big sausages and having her sing. Oh, sounds, it looks so
blooming marvelous.
Yeah. I love that scene. Absolutely love it.
Yeah.
Ted, any comments?
No. I would not have known her, I'm afraid. And I would now need to look up those things to remind myself where I might have seen her.
Okay. Well, next up is Patrick Murray, who passed away at 68, who is very well known as playing Mickey Pierce in Only Fools and Horses. He was also in Quadrophenia and Scum. Thanks, Ted, for filling in the show notes there. So I knew where else I knew him from other than Only Fools and Horses, which he's really well known for. Ted, do you have any more comments on
it? Yeah, that's it, really. He's obviously the most well-known for that. And actually, in Fools and Horses, he doesn't play a huge part. He's not in every episode by any stretch. He's a kind of, secondary character, really. But, because Fools and Horses is so well-watched, I think most people in the UK, Americans tune out here because most people in the UK will know him very well, and most Americans won't, I guess. Alan?
Yeah, I actually was not aware of him, certainly not by name. I think I will have seen him, obviously, in the Fools and Horses stuff, but no, I couldn't have placed him or given you the name, no.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, he was in The Curse of the Pink Panther in 1983 with Ted Wass.
Oh, wow.
The same is probably true, Gareth, of the next person who's passed away at 96, Patricia Routledge. This is another American tune-out moment, I think, because I don't think people in America will know who she is. But people in Britain, certainly of my age, will have grown up with Keeping Up Appearances, where she played Hyacinth Bouquet. Hetty Wainthrop. I remember her. I mean, she's been in tons of stuff, working since 1954. She lived in Chichester, incidentally, just down the road from where I was. So she was a local kind of celebrity to where I was. And I remember one scene in the Step Two episode where she plays this medium, and she's really funny in that. And I had completely forgotten that she was in To Sir From Love, and I put a picture of her in To Sir With Love in the recording notes there, so you can see. And I would never have remembered that. And she looks much older than she really is there in this classroom scene in To Sir With Love. It's just spooky. But yeah, Patricia Routledge, 96.
Wow. What you said, Hetty Wainthrop? What was that again? That name.
She was like a Agatha Christie kind of, she did investigations and a bit like Murder, She Wrote or something, I think.
Right, okay. Like a modern day one. Oh, yeah, I've got a picture of it, which gives your man Pippin from Lord of the Rings.
Right, yeah.
Right. Well, I'd completely forgotten about that since the last time I heard it. Next on ITV.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the next two names share something similar, and it's kind of spooky that we lost these two so close. The first is Renato Cassaro, who is an incredible poster designer, and you know his work. He did The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Army of Darkness, the aforementioned Quadrophenia, Flash Gordon, Conan the Barbarian, Dario Argento's Tenebrae, Octopussy, the James Bond film, Never Say Never Again, the James Bond film, both of which were 1983, and he did the artwork for both of them. How does that work? Rambo, First Blood Part 2, the international version of that, because I think the American one was a photograph, Red Sonja, and Flesh and Blood. He also did Escape from New York and Dune and The Neverending Story, Island of the Fishmen, I discovered recently because I reviewed that on my site quite recently. But, you know, he's one of those classic poster artists that just paints the most beautiful, incredible visual images that you remember, and sells the film to you entirely. You know, its whole runtime is there, you know, for you to just get a sampler of, and it's correct. You know, it's not like some, you look at posters today and they're just horrible by comparison. You guys know his stuff. What do you think of his stuff? I put some of them in the show notes for you to see.
Stunning, so beautiful, really beautiful, especially the one with Ming at the top, you know. Incredible for Flash Gordon. I didn't know his name, and I didn't know that this body of work was all from one person. So thank you for making me aware of that. But I mean, like, it's stunningly beautiful work.
How's he doing this, Gareth?
Well, I think they do them by brush. You know.
Oh, right. It's like manuals, not electronic, you know, not digitally.
No, painting.
Well, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was made in the late 60s, so sitting down at a computer and doing this is not that easy. No, it's all brushwork.
Right, okay. Well, then Alan is right. It's just brilliant, isn't it?
It's stunning. Yeah, like, yeah. Look at the face on Ming there at the top of that, and the lighting.
Yeah.
And also the burden of responsibility that's on the poster designer. You've got one image to, you know, to really hook the audience in. You know, for a product that's cost tens, 20, 30, 40 million dollars, you know, you need to have somebody who's got some chops. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, I think some of them don't actually end up getting used. Like, if you have, I put in one there of Escape from New York, and that wasn't used. You know, the imagery that they went with is different to that. So, and I even think the one for Dune wasn't used either. But I think if there was a movie poster over the last five decades that you feel is memorable, it was drawn by one of two men, because we lost the other man as well, who I would say his posters are slightly better known, and that's Drew Sturzen. And he did the likes of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and Star Wars, The Phantom Menace, Episode One, The Flintstones, Battery Not Included, Hook. I think he did all the Star Wars ones. Rambo, First Blood, Shawshank Redemption, The Thing, The Goonies, Coming to America, The Wizard of Oz, Blade Runner.
Holy
incredible Molly. Stuff. Yeah. It's difficult to even list the amount of films, but whenever you see them, you just know that's part of my childhood, or I remember that coming out. I remember the poster better than the film.
Yeah. These are definitive, you know, in a sense. You look at the Indiana Jones and the Star Wars stuff, you just go, oh, that is what a movie poster is. And from this, everything else is a derivative. You know, that style, that quality, the composition, the lighting, everything, the montage of images. And it's incredible how influential. I had no idea this fella did all these incredible standout artworks.
Be interesting it'd be interesting to get a coffee table book, you know, a nice big one with each page showing one of the.
Yeah.
Maybe you can. I don't know.
Yeah,
you can. There was one released recently. There was also a documentary done about Drew over the last couple of years that talked about his habits. But you know, I look at the poster of The Goonies, where Josh Brolin's clinging to the stalagmite, the bit of rock, with all the kids hanging off it, and I think, you know, that just absolutely captures the movie. In one, you know, that there's There's nothing that could even be better than that poster that captures the spirit of the movie. So, you know, it takes years. It takes people years to actually come to appreciate a movie, to fall in love with a movie, to know exact, to be able to go away and create a depiction. Mm. Yet he was able to do that from the base model, or the most basic things that are available, production skill stills. Maybe he saw an early
probably
unscored version of the film. I think Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, it didn't have a score and it had different scenes in it whenever the poster was designed. So he would have seen something else.
Some kind of early work edit or something.
Yeah. And then, you know, he's not allowed to go and re-edit the poster. It's already done. He spent countless hours sitting at his easel, you know, painting away and doing alternatives. And you know, they take those elements and combine them together. So he has to, he would have to turn up with all of his elements and they would go, I like that, and that. Merge them together into this and eventually come up with an incredible poster. So much work that goes into it. And, you know, we did it so many times.
It's an absolute maestro. Incredible. Incredible. And the Hellboy posters, Back to the Future as well. Yeah. It is.
Very sad. And very good quality stuff, certainly. I think we're at the end here. We're over 2 hours now, I think. And we're sorry if you're still with us at this stage, then sorry it's been so long, but we had a bit of a catch-up show, really. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with a ordinary length one, probably, if you're lucky. In the meantime, you can get to see Gareth's stuff at garethmiles.com. You can get to projectorroom.co.uk for all the stuff that links out from what we've been talking about today. It will also be in your podcatcher, of course. We'd like to see you in the MeWe group. So do come across and join us in the MeWe group. If you get lost with any of that, tedsalmon.com is where you can find links to all the MeWe groups, all the other audio podcasts from me and the team. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us in 2 weeks' time next time in the Projector Room.